Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
But you're smiling.
Am I?
You most certainly are.
That's probably because I'm happy, sir.
What are you happy about?
Everything. I make good money, got a nice place to live, my health, money in the bank, I like my job.
But you couldn't possibly. I treat you atrociously.
Oh, you don't bother me, Mr. Fortune. You tickle me. Sometimes it's all I can do to keep from laughing out loud when you have one of your tantrums. I get a great kick of it when you go around flicking the furniture to see if I dust it or checking the silver to see if it's polished.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, folks, one and all. My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. And I am here with the greatest co-host on the planet. That is Bobby, Robert, and Dave. Hey! Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
And Dave's back. My goodness. Hello, Dave. It's been like you've been on a respite from the show here.
Yeah, apologies to anybody who's missed me. I was on a family event one of the weekends.
You.
thank you very much. I was on a family event one of the weekends, but I got my weekends mixed up last fortnight. But I am pleased that I made it for this one, because I think this show is going to be one that many people will have liked.
Yeah, well.
Don't bet on it.
Ooh.
I'm glad you're back, and we did miss you. And hey, Ed, you know, you're right. Ed said that we need a new intro, one that doesn't say for the next 30 minutes we'll be talking. Only problem is that intro was from our old show that we used to do on KSAV radio. This was back in 2009, and it was on KSAV radio, which is an internet radio station, and the host there did the intro for us, and he said it was, you know, for the next, and it was only a 30-minute show. We could not go over. It was, you know, 30 minutes, and that was it. At the end of 30 minutes, we were off.
We're doing Talking Twilight Zone. Time is relative, where it might be an hour here.
Right.
Yeah. Else,
well, we asked him if we could use his intro for the new show. And when we asked him, he said that was fine. We had talked to Logan about, when we first started the group, we talked to Logan about changing 30 minutes to either saying nothing or 60 minutes. And he had a hard time changing it because it was right in the middle. So we just left it the way it was. But that's okay. Everybody knows that we always go over 30 minutes anyway. Yeah. But it's, but no, I understand.
Yeah.
Well,
it depends on what we're having that day. How far we go
exactly
over.
You're right. And Ed is actually the second person to ask me about that. Somebody, he will not sue us. Bear fan. He told us we could use it, Bear Fan. Mr. Ron over there being a smart ass. No, we can use it.
Oh, and thank you, Ron, for playing Talking Twilight Zone on your radio station there. And
I did send you episode
78, just to let you know.
Thank you so much, Ron. We really appreciate that. So anyway, that's the deal with the opening clip. And maybe one of these days we can get it changed. But I think everybody knows now that we're 60 minutes or more. So anyway, I want to welcome Ron and, of course, Ed. And
Where's Felix?
And Felix
from Dorsey. He ain't here. What's up with that?
Oh, Felix is here. Oh, yeah, he hasn't been here for a couple of weeks. And we have another guest here, Am I Human? Well, I hope you are, because if you are, you can join in on our conversation. We have guest number 6 here, and we are ready to go. So, today's episode is called A Piano in the House.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Mr. Fitzgerald Fortune, theater critic and cynic at large, on his way to a birthday party. If he knew what is in store for him, he probably wouldn't go. Because before this evening is over, that cranky old piano is going to play those piano roll blues with some effects that could happen only in the Twilight Zone.
We've got a drama critic named Fitzgerald Fortune. And Fitzgerald goes to Throckmorton's Curio Shop to buy his young wife, Esther, a player piano as a present for her 26th birthday. So at the shop, you have a grouchy, miserable shop owner. He wants absolutely nothing to do with his customers. Nice way to run a business, but he wants nothing to do with his customers. And Fitzgerald, he comes in and he says, oh, Fitzgerald is also known as Jerry, you know, for the Gerald. And he comes in and he tells the guy, I want to buy a player piano. So the shop owner, as miserable as he is, says, I have one. And he said, you know, I'll demonstrate it. So he decides to play the piano for Fitzgerald. And suddenly, as the music is playing, he reveals his soft, sentimental side. He becomes like this unbelievably ungrouchy person, and he's very sentimental about Jerry's wife's birthday. So Fitzgerald Fortune immediately realizes that this piano has magical properties that causes its whoever listens to it causes it to reveal a person's true feelings. So naturally he buys it. So later at home, after it's delivered, his very solemn, almost catatonic butler Marvin bursts out laughing under the influence of the piano and reveals that he actually enjoys working for Fortune. Then when Fortune puts on a roll of music for his wife Esther, she calls him a beast and reveals that she detests him for his cruelty to her and all the people around him. He then tries it out on one of his wife's party guests, a playwright named Greg Walker, who admits to being in love with Esther and that they had a little fling while she was on vacation with Jerry, and that was while the music was playing for him. So during the party, Jerry chooses a guest, an overweight woman named Marge Moore, in order to demonstrate to everyone else the piano's effects. And as the music
that
Jerry...
ball in the room. Huh?
The bouncing ball, exactly. The bouncing ball. And as the music that Jerry has chosen for her plays, Marge decides to that, or doesn't decide, she just goes into a trance, and she calls herself Tina. And she dances around the room and admits to really wanting to be as light and graceful and as beautifully formed as a snowflake. And she moves around with this surprising delicacy, and she's in this trance. And then when the music stops, well, she's obviously humiliated. She's embarrassed. And, you know, she comes back to reality, and it's just unbelievable what he's done to her. So Jerry then announces that he's going to reveal the devil himself to everyone around him. And he hands Esther a new roll of music to put into the piano, but she swaps it for a different one, a lullaby. And when the lullaby begins to play, everyone looks to see who will be affected. It ends up being Jerry, who reveals himself to be nothing more than a frightened and sadistic child who's jealous of the others around him. He admits to writing bad reviews for Greg's plays because he's jealous of his talent. He also admits to Esther that the reason he treats her so terribly is because he can't understand or accept love. So obviously, you know, disturbed by all of this, the guests begin to leave, and Gregory and Esther end up leaving together because Gregory is the one who's really in love with Esther, and she's really in love with him. So then a rejected and devastated Jerry throws a tantrum, breaks glasses, breaks dishes, ruins the piano roll by pulling it out and ripping it up. And finally, Marvin, the catatonic butler, walks in and finds Jerry in the middle of his tirade, and Jerry tells Marvin not to laugh at him, and Marvin says, "I'm not laughing, Mr. Fortune. You're not funny anymore."
Great line.
Great line. Spoken by the great Cyril Belvonte. Yes. I thought this was an interesting episode. It was a little weak in some spots, I admit. But, well, first of all, the main character, played by Barry Morse, he has the ridiculous name of Fitzgerald Fortune, which I thought was a rather, I don't know, comical name, more suitable for a cartoon character, not a sadistic theater critic. You know, I mean, you find more sadistical names in David Copperfield. You know, Fitzgerald Fortune, something you find like some rabbit or something in a cartoon. But nevertheless, Morse played the part very well, especially in the shots where he had those almost satanic looks on his face and laughed, that devious, sadistic laugh. And he was a real jackass to everyone. And he thought he was being kind by purchasing this player piano for his wife to discourage her from taking piano lessons. And the creep even went so far as to tell her to her face that he bought it because he knew she had no talent. I mean, he had no regard for her feelings or anyone's feelings. So, but unfortunately, this player piano had a power that was very dangerous in the hands of a sadist like Fortune. And the music played, and it caused people to reveal their true feelings, so this jerk used it to his advantage. So Fortune, he saw how miserable, or when he went into the curio shop, you know, he saw that the miserable owner turned mellow and sentimental when the piano played "I'm in the Mood for Love." And then when Smiles was playing, Marvin, the butler, he seemed to suppress any and all emotions most of the time, and he became deliriously happy. And Saber Dance was the one that caused Esther to tell Jerry how much she despised him. And then he gets it to use, used it to get Greg to profess his true feelings of love for Esther. And he got their rather large party guest, Marge, to reveal her fantasies of being a dainty little dancer. So I thought it was great. Finally, Esther has to play Brahms' Lullaby, right? Brahms' Lullaby? Yeah. And that makes Fortune reveal himself to be nothing more than a frightened little kid, a little child. He's scared of everyone around him. He's jealous of everyone around him. So it was quite fitting that everyone walked out on him at the end, and his wife left with the man who truly loved her.
But I can understand this, Lynn. You would think that she would have known this before she married him. I mean, by just the way he acted.
Well,
how was the romance between the two? That's what I couldn't understand.
See, I think the problem with that is that she, you got to figure she was 20. This was supposed to be her 26th birthday. So I'm getting the impression that they've been married a few years, maybe 3-4 years, at the something like that. So she was probably a child.
I think she said she was 19. Wasn't it 19 when they got married?
19? All right, there you go. So she was a kid. She was a kid, and she marries this famous, or at least everyone thinks he's a famous, you know, play critic or theater critic. Okay, so she marries this theater critic. And he's obviously at least 10 or 15 years older than she is. So she's 19. You got to figure that he's 29, 30-something. And she probably was very, vulnerable, naive.
I think he was supposed to be about 20 years older than her. I think when she was 25, he's middle-aged, 45. Well, what was called middle-aged then?
You
got
to figure at least 15 to 20 years older than her, sure. So she was a young kid. She probably figured, well, you know, this older man, he's going to take care of me. You know, he loves me and this guy. And then she realized as time went on that he was a creep, you know. But I think that's the thing, Robert, is that she was too young to even know what love was or even know that, you know, this guy was a complete self-centered jerk. That's what I figure from it. Yeah, and she said it. She said she put up with her for years. And so, obviously, you know, she just didn't know what else to do at that point. She was kind of stuck under his thumb in a way. What I didn't like about this episode was, and I really liked the episode, but what I didn't like was the length of the scene with Marge Moore. Because I thought it lasted a little bit too long. It was getting a little boring. I mean, I liked the fact that you know, he got her up and, you know, she was saying, oh, my name is Tina. You know, and she wanted to be a dancer and the dancing part. But then after that, it went on even further where she wanted to be a snowflake. And it just, it went on just a little bit too long for me. But I, in retrospect, though, looking at it, I have to applaud Muriel Landers who portrayed March, because she played this woman beautifully. I mean, she plays a robust woman who jokes about her own weight. You know, she obviously can be self-deprecating. Yeah, exactly. And she, you know, she was really a fun-loving person who did embrace life, which was the thing that the jury at the end said he was jealous of her, because she embraces life no matter, you know, whether her weight's high or not. You know, but so she plays this big woman. And when Claire de Lune was played on the piano, she gave a very intense and poignant performance. It was a bit long, but she did a beautiful job with that role. And then when the music stopped playing, if you look at her face, I mean, just the expressions. I mean, it revealed like this utter betrayal, this devastation, humiliation, and she portrayed the whole thing. So I got to give her credit. She did a beautiful job with that role. And then, of course, Cyril Delavante, I can never say enough about it. I love this guy. It was a great bit of acting, both on Muriel's part and Cyril. They were the two that really, I had a good time with those two. And Cyril Delavante, he was delightful as Marvin. You know, the giddy, grinning, turnabout thing when the music played. He's a joy to watch. He's been in about four or five Twilight Zone episodes. He's been in Penny for Your Thoughts. He's been in The Silence. He's been in four or five, and he's always been terrific. He's just a joy. And Philip Coolidge, who played the curio shop dealer, he did an excellent job. And Barry Morse, of course, is best known as Lieutenant Philip Gerard in that other classic TV series, The Fugitive. And he's much better in that series. I think he was a perfect choice to play Fitzgerald Fortune. And Joan Hackett did a great job of playing his wife, unhappy wife, Esther. So, and oh, one last thing. I like the scene when he says to Esther, I've always believed that we all have two faces, one that we wear and the other we keep hidden. And actually, that's probably true of many people. We've all probably known people who aren't really what they seem to be. So I thought the concept of the story was a good one. It's not a perfect episode that seems marches long, but overall the performances were great, and I'm giving this a 3 for good. And I just want to mention that, let me see who's saying something here. Ron loves the butler, but he said, Robert, you remind him of the butler. You do hear that, don't you?
Oh, by the way, Ron, how did Illinois do today? You played Penn State, didn't you? Didn't they creamed you 45-0 or something like that?
Little payback there. And Ed here is saying that, Ed also loves Cyril Delavante, the butler. He said he just died during the giggling scene. Yeah. I thought that was fantastic. It was an absolutely tremendous scene. So I'm going to turn it over now to Robert the butler.
I'm not laughing. You're not very
I noticed
funny
that. Anymore. Yell at Ron. Don't yell at me.
Don't laugh at me.
I'm not laughing, Mr. Fortune. You're not funny anymore.
Well, anyway. Thank you, Lynn.
Robert Delafonte.
Well, with this episode, I felt had a very dramatic feel. Barry Morse did a pretty good job as Fitzgerald, but I like better the butler. I think he was the gem of the piece, so to say.
Right.
The story itself very much reminds me of a Friday 13th, the series episode where you have the curiosity shop, you walk in there and get the curse object. And with this time around, the curse object is a piano, but that kind of brought a question to me that was it the piano itself? Or was it the piano rolls that were cursed? I kind of wish that that part was explained a little bit better.
That's a good question.
I mean, there should have been a scene where someone just played the piano itself without the music roll, just to prove my theory of if it was actually the piano or if it was the music roles themselves. So I kind of lean towards it, the music roles more than
well,
the piano.
I was just going to say, if you were to take a guess, I would say the roles too. I would say it's the roles, yeah. Because if you played them on another player piano, do you think they would? Yeah, if I were to guess, I would say it would were the roles rather than the piano. Yeah.
Because the music is where to focus. It's not spread out to everybody in the room. It triggers a certain person, which is kind of interesting that it would focus. The music would focus that way, that narrow of a band, you know. Whereas everybody else would hear the music, that one person would, you know, actually tune in with the music. So,
didn't you wonder too how he knew which song would affect which person? That, I mean, you had all those people in that drawing room, in that room there, you know, where the piano was, and he just knew that particular role of music would affect Marge. Why didn't it affect anybody else in the room?
Maybe because he seen what it did to the shopkeeper when he demonstrated the piano to Fitzgerald, and the emotion that the shopkeeper gave, kind of a sentimental type of feel when the music was playing, you know, for him. And maybe he figured out, well, it must be keyed into a certain person. So, I mean, unless Fitzgerald had and never said in the episode or showed in the episode that he had any kind of sensory perception of people, maybe he's a judge of character from the reviews that he did, you know, with the theater reviews. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. But, you know, being married to someone for so long, you kind of figure things out. He probably figured out for her what would be the appropriate music. That's just a guess on my part. It is kind of weird that, you know, a psychiatrist, when you go to a psychiatrist, you know, the psychiatrist sits with you and he goes over things with you, you know, with your life, and kind of hones in with what you say to help you figure out how to get through something.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it could be something like that.
That makes sense. I was just wondering, like, how do you know which songs? And he picked people out. You know, like
right.
He picked Greg when Greg came in. You know, how did he know that particular song that he played was going to make Greg, you know, admit that he was in love with his wife, Esther? How did he know Claire de Lune was going to be the song to make Marge dance? How did he know that? Well, he didn't know about Smiles for the butler. That's what blew him away when he played Smiles and Marvin started, you know, grinning and everything. But I just don't know how he knew which ones would. But I don't know. That's well,
suspension,
it's his own
of disbelief, probably with that.
Yeah, it's the zone. It's the zone. He was in the zone.
But you know, the like I said. I really like the butler, Cyrano. He did a brilliant job, you know. And you have imagine trying to be, you know, motionless through this thing, not show no emotion at all. I mean, that is very hard for an actor to try to do. And you know, my compliments to him for the role as a butler that he did. I mean, he did that very well. I mean, you couldn't. He'd be great in poker if you, you know, want to go to a poker place and
with the
know,
poker face.
Yeah, with the poker face, he'd be brilliant. He'd be breaking in the money with that face. But unfortunately, the rest of the episode left me motionless. You know, I found the episode, you know, parts of the episode quite boring, and needing a transfusion of life itself. And if that's the way dinner parties were back then, boring, I definitely wouldn't want to go to one of them. So. But I do remember the antique shops that I've gone into, and I have seen a piano player. I mean, you know, a player piano with the rolls, which was kind of cool. But what's kind of an interesting fact is that they switched from the piano rolls to computer tapes, and they came out with the organs that you insert a tape and it would run off the tape itself. You didn't need
Yeah.
That was back in the 70s and 80s, which was kind of cool. Radio Shack had
the good old
one
days.
Like that. Yep.
I love the 70s, yeah.
Just a little information about Barry Morris, who died at 89 in 2008. As you said,
that's
he was
right.
Abusive. 89. Yeah, Space 1999. He also did movies, theater, and directing. He wrote his autobiography, Remember What Advantage Is, which was released in 2007. And, of course, this episode was another one written by Earl Hammer Jr., the second of eight stories. The first one was The Hunt, which we mentioned. And then the last one, finishing up the Twilight Zone series, Season 5, Episode 156, The Bewitching Pool.
I'll be leaving the group by then.
No.
Oh, God.
But my rating for this was a 2.5 out of 5.
That's cool.
So
that is cool.
With that, I'll pass it on to Bobby.
Okay, you will add your clips later, won't you?
If I can get this thing to work. If not, then
yeah, if you get to work.
What you hear is what you hear.
Okay, Bobby.
2.5 rating for something that's really boring, huh? Boy, oh boy.
I said in parts. I
really being
thing.
Very generous today.
I gave it a 3.
Like the butler. He was laughing.
Me too.
I love that.
Yeah. I thought the acting was very well on everybody's part.
Well, I bring certain prejudice to this episode because, to start with, I don't particularly enjoy episodes that feature inanimate objects that take on a life of their own and either teach somebody a lesson or call some evil person to get his comeuppance. It can be interesting at times, but it's too easy to just, whether it's a piano or anything else, to just set it up and have it do what people would normally do. There's really no emotion there, so it doesn't really turn me on. I don't particularly like stories like that. Also, as you probably, some people could probably predict, people who know me at least, I can't really I know Barry Morse had a distinguished career. He did many, many things, and he was an excellent actor and an author, too. But if you go to IMDb and you look him up, you'll see that it says right away that for most of Americans, at least on American TV, he'll always be Lieutenant Gerard in The Fugitive. And it's very difficult to accept him in any other part. I simply can't look at him without thinking about the part that he played as Gerard.
So you think he typecast himself, Bobby?
Well, I think every actor is typecast. What happened to Sylvester Stallone? He's always be Rocky. So, I mean, that's true of everybody who is in anything, whether it's a movie or TV series that is successful. It carries you around and it's on your back and never get rid of it. Now, he did manage to get rid of it because he did many other things. And so you have to admire that. He didn't allow it. And in The Fugitive, he was only in about a third of the episodes, and that shows how memorable he was. Many, many weeks went by without him even being there. I will agree with what Robert said. It is really very, very boring, not only at times, but most of the time. And I gave it a rating of 2. I must have been having a great day that day, because that's kind of generous. I think if I did it today, it would be more like 1.5. It's not terrible, and that's because of the acting. However, one of the problems I have with The Twilight Zone, I've mentioned this before and I'll probably mention it again, is that anytime you have an episode in The Twilight Zone and you talk mainly about the actors, which is what everybody's done so far today, and no doubt other people will as well, I have a problem with that, because The Twilight Zone really is not about acting. It never has been. Yes, I enjoy great acting as much as anybody else, and that's a part of any story, whether it's a movie or a TV episode, but The Twilight Zone is unique in that you don't really go there to see great acting. You go there to see unusual stories that are very compelling or very surprising or terrifying, if you will. And this is just a very mundane episode to me. It just doesn't – I can enjoy the acting. I agree. The acting is great. But there's no real story behind it, and that's what bothers me about it. Every episode in The Twilight Zone in which I have to sit here and say, yeah, the acting was good, but I have a problem with the but. This is the story that's very weak. Also, it basically is just a film stage play. That's all it is. Many times, professional critics, when films come out and they take place in one setting or they just feature a lot of talk, will say it's basically just a film stage play, and they don't really like that, and neither do I. I don't think it's very interesting. I've been to a lot of plays in my life, and I knew where I was. I was in the theater watching it, so it took place in one, just on the stage, and I can accept that. But I'm watching something like The Twilight Zone, I really don't get much out of it when it all takes place, or most of it. I know the beginning is in that little curio shop, but when most of it takes place in one setting and people are just talking to each other. And so that bothers me too. There's a lot that just bored me about this episode. Lynn and I watched it earlier today. And again, it's one of those episodes, like a lot that we've been doing lately, that I don't bother to watch. That's all, it's there. And there are certain episodes in this series that you watch countless times. No matter how many times you see it, you never get tired of it. And there are certain episodes that you just avoid, like the play, at least I do. If it's on, I may watch it if I have nothing better to do. But I don't look for it. And if I took out the DVD set, I would never pull this one out to watch because it's just not memorable enough for me. So that's one of the problems I have with it. The story itself, the business about the piano is, it could have been a little creepier, I think, than it was. It was just kind of mundane. I wanted to be a little more freaked out about this piano causing people to change their personalities than I was. It just kind of meandered along and went absolutely nowhere. And
you would have been arrested. There was a song that turned someone to Jack the Ripper, and he went around killing everybody. Then it ended. Well, that's what happens in the Twilight Zone, folks.
No, I don't. No, come on. I don't want a story like that. No, I just want an interesting story. I don't always have to have science fiction or horror or anything like that. But I just have to have. I mean, you said it yourself. You said that you praised it, and then you went, yeah, but then in the middle of it, it got boring and it dragged on. And a 23-minute episode should not be boring. And that's what The Twilight Zone is, 23, 25 minutes. And if you can't stay awake for 23 minutes, you got a problem there. So that's it. So I gave it in my review, like I said, I gave it a 2. And for those people who weren't fortunate enough to read my brilliant review, at the end of it I said that if this episode had been filmed about 4 or 5 years later than it was, after The Fugitive had ended, it could have had a very, very interesting Twilight Zone kind of ending if you crossed the series together, and that is that Richard Kimball enters the room at the end, and the piano starts playing, and he changes his personality and admits that he really did kill his wife after all, and he simply gives Mr. Fortune the finger, and he walks out the door. I would have thought that would have a more Twilight Zone feel to it. I would have enjoyed that. Of course, it's ridiculous, but it would have been more interesting. As it stands, it's not much for me. I gave it a 2, somewhere between a 1.5 and a 2. And by the way, Robert mentioned Barry Morse's excellent career. And one thing he didn't mention is that Barry Morse was married to the same woman his entire life for 60 years.
Ooh.
60 years. And anybody who can stay married to one person for 60 years deserves a lot of praise indeed.
So you're saying
he's 40 more years to go. So.
Most people can't stay married for 6 years, much less 6 decades.
So he got married when he was like, what, 29?
That's
right.
He
got married at 29?
That's correct.
Wow.
And so Lynn and I will take that hint, and we only have to stay married now for 58 more years.
58 more years. Exactly.
We'll get back to you on that and tell you how it worked out.
And by the way, let me ask you something. You say you don't like cursed object things, but you like the movie by Steven Spielberg, Christine, about the haunted car, don't you?
I generally don't. Yeah, that was, well, I'm not wild about that movie, but yeah, it's because it's creepier. It's a creepier story than
well,
this.
Well, and plus it's a
it's
movie,
not just
so
about,
you have more.
It's not just about turning people's personalities against themselves and other people. This was a car that took on a life of its own. It's basically a horror story. And yeah, and I'm not a Stephen King fan, but of the movies made out of Stephen King novels, that's the one I can sit through. Yeah, but that's
true. You're not
true.
A Stephen King fan.
Nope, I am not.
You know, I don't even know who you are anymore.
What piano music would be good for Bobby, Lynn? We'll have to think on that.
I don't know. He's not a Stephen. I thought he was a Stephen King fan.
Nope, not really.
I don't know who he is anymore. And plus,
well, so much for staying married for 60 years.
My goodness. And plus, Chris, you know, you got to remember they're movies, so they get fleshed out more. You know, it's not like it's a 23-minute TV show that, you know, you've got an episode, 23 minutes, and you can't flesh it out. So, a movie can be fleshed out. But you don't like Steven Spielberg, and I thought I knew
Steven
who
Spielberg,
I was
Stephen King.
Or Stephen King, oh yeah.
There's a
vast
difference
between
Spielberg
totally
and King.
Yeah, now I'm totally confused.
Spielberg is cutesy. King
Spielberg.
Is killing.
All right, Stephen King. Well, anyway, how can you not like Stephen King?
I don't know.
We love Stephen King. My wife loves to read. She's got tons of his books here, and she's a
happy for
okay. Stephen King fan.
Well, I mean, movies are tremendous. I mean, I can't
Christine
believe
is a
Cujo?
Good is a good movie.
Yeah, and Cujo, and oh my God, The Shining.
But so you also got the miniseries that you know. The Landoliers, Rose Red, The Stand, that are pretty good that
yeah.
King did.
But he's got a lot
I don't
of
read his
things.
Stuff because I can't get into 1,000-some pages of The Stand.
Yeah, I know. His books are too long. That's why I watch the movies, and the movies are fabulous. Pet Sematary and Carrie. And,
yeah.
Oh, come on, Bobby. You know you like Stephen King.
Not really. Okay, so I'll keep this at somewhere between 1.5 and 2.
All right, and Dave, now it's your turn.
Okay, I'll be a bit more positive than that. Just for those people listening who are not aware, this was Series 3, Episode 87, aired first on February 16th, 1962. Yeah, and again, it's them getting more than one story out of the thing. You mentioned A Penny for Your Thoughts. Which was Series 2, Episode 52, which was the one with the penny standing on its end and people had to tell the truth, which in a sense what was happening here, people were telling the truth. So this was could have been called A Song for Your Thoughts, but, you know, there you go. I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was rather bizarre when he suddenly announced that he was going to bring forth the devil. I mean, that seemed to be a little bit of a twist too far to me. I think he might say, well, you know, I had a fair idea that those people would be influenced by that music, but this piece I don't know because I don't know the other people in the room so well. And therefore, then they would have been looking around to see who was influenced, but of course it was him, but not necessarily because he was trying to invoke the devil. Just going back to the actor, Barry Morse, of course, he is from the UK and he's known as much here in the UK for being in Space 1999 with Martin Landau and Barbara Bain, Landau's wife. But in a strange parallel to this story, in real life, Barry Morse's wife, which was we've just heard they were married to for a long time, Sydney, what's it called? Sydney Sturgis. I don't know if she's related to the director Sturgis, but even more noble because she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and had that illness for the last 14 years of their marriage, so they had that. And in another connection with the episode, she was born in 1944. Barry was born in 1918, so he was 26 years older than his real life wife. So,
didn't know that. Wow.
Just a little bit of excitement. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
I enjoyed the interesting thing you were saying about whether it was the piano or whether it was the scrolls. I suppose if the scrolls were indeed the things that were enchanted, one would have thought he'd have an intuitive idea of which one will let out his inner child. And you think that would have been the first one he chucked on the fire, you know. So as not to relieve, you know, because, I mean, the last thing you do is you're having all these people, you know, being brought vulnerable. The last thing you would want is your own secrets being brought out, one would have thought. So you would have searched for the one and destroyed that, I would have thought. So that's that.
I don't think he knew which one was going to affect him. I don't think he thought he would be affected by any of them. He was so self-centered he believed that he could affect everyone else and he was immune to it.
Right.
That's what I think.
Right. But we've had this theme before as well. I mean, it's slightly different. We had the chap with the typewriter, not the typewriter, the dictation machine, and he could conjure things up. But I think the pairing is probably the Penny for Your Thoughts one. Joan Hackett, I mean, I was looking through a wiki page, and there's not an awful lot I recognise there, but I was very, very, as soon as I saw her on the screen, because I watched it again myself today, you know, she has one of those faces that I really remember when I was growing up. I think it was a bit like, I can't remember the name of the actress now, but if you've ever watched Perry Mason, the actress who played...
Oh, you want to play Della?
Della
Street?
Yeah. Della Street. I always had a crush on her when I was a young
Gale,
man.
Gail Storm, wasn't it?
Right, okay, yeah. And this actress seemed to me to be, not. I mean, I wasn't mixing her up with her, but I seemed to have a very strong recollection of seeing her on TV. But when I looked through her credits, they're not necessarily the sort of shows I would have watched, although she was in, you know, comedy western Support Your Local Sheriff, western Will Penny with Charlton Heston, and she was in a few things like that. Yes, I can see the flaws now they've been pointed out. It was a little bit long-winded, the scene with the dancer. I was thinking, again, with that, I was thinking of Shelley Winters acting that part out. If you remember singing the Titanic, you know, where she holds them back because she can't get to all the narrow spaces, but they come to the bit where they've got to go underwater. And
right.
She says, can anybody else hold the second for the breath for 40 seconds or something? And, you know, she wanted to do it because it was one thing where in the water, her weight wasn't a disadvantage, and she was like a, you know, like a, I don't know, you know, she was like a porpoise in the water, where this woman here was, you know, very, as you say, very light on her feet and did that well. The other thing I was going to say about Penny for Your Thoughts, which was the other story that liked it, it had that same actor, and that was the actor that played Cyril that was the other episode.
Cyril Delavante.
So he must have thought he'd gone for the same part, and they'd just changed the script somewhat because it's basically the same story he was in.
Dale Street was played by Barbara Hale. Perry Mason series ran from 1957 to 1966.
Right.
Now, who was Gail Storm then? Gail Storm played. I thought she was in Perry Mason.
She had her own show. She had Gail Storm.
Yeah, but I thought she was somebody's assistant. Well, I guess I'm wrong about that. Okay. All right. So it was Barbara Hale.
Yeah, Barbara
Hale.
Yeah. And she played in the TV movies as well.
So. Yeah.
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 But she had one of those faces that it was coming back to me out of the past as somebody I'd seen. I probably had a bit of a crush on as well at the time. So, but I don't necessarily recognise a lot of her credits when I look at the wiki page. So I was actually going to give this a good 3.5. It's certainly a 3, I think. But I realised that you know, there could have been an extra twist. There could have been, you know, a little less padding, which I absolutely agree with Bobby. You shouldn't really need any padding in a 23-minute story. There's no call for it, really. You're basically normally trying to shoehorn the story into that time limit. You know, it's almost as though, you know, Rod Sterling said to the writers, you know, a little bit, I think it was Ronald Reagan, wasn't it? It's famously, we said in the UK anyway, it was famously believed, anyway, that Ronald Reagan said to all his advisers, don't bring me any assessment of any political story that's more than one page long. They have to condense it down to one page.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Oh, my God, I forgot all about that.
And I've got a feeling that that's exactly what they do with these scripts. If it doesn't fit on one piece of paper.
That's right. He did say that. Oh, wow. I can't believe that. I forgot all about that. I'm glad you reminded me of that.
Yeah.
I
thought it was a bit better than what has become the average story. Normally, in a good season, this would be average. But although I wasn't on for a couple of the other ones, I think this was a watchable story. And I would watch it again. Wouldn't rush to watch it, but I'm going to say 3 now, not 3.5.
Yeah, I would watch it again. I have no problem with it. I mean, like I said, the only thing that bothered me was Marge, thing was a little longer than it should have been, you know, the, when Marge Moore was up there. But other than that, I had no problem with it. I love Cyril Delafondi. I watch him anytime, and he did it. And the that was the best ending. The best part of the episode was the ending when he says, "I'm not laughing, Mr. Fortune. You're not funny anymore." I mean, that was.
I'm afraid that Lynn has a thing for little old men.
I do.
That's
I really,
why she married me.
Little old wrinkled up men. All right, I'm going to turn this over now to Ed.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Hi, Ed. How's it going? Welcome back.
Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll be brief because I think a lot of what I was going to say, I think a lot of you have said. I don't think I enjoyed it quite as much as some of you did.
Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know if it's for the same reasons or not, but
you're funny.
It was, you know, it had the spark of a decent idea, as a lot of the episodes do. But in this one, you know, I like the idea that it's a piano that brings out the, you know, the person's inner person that they keep secret. You know, I think that was a neat idea. As Lynn was saying, it's just hokey that, you know, Fitzgerald Fortune could specifically target a person based on the music. You know, he just got this piano. He doesn't know anything about it, but he knows, you know, he knows after one or two experiences exactly how to select just the right music, you know. And it was
too weird. That was too weird that he just knew what songs to play for each person.
Yeah, almost like instinctually he knew which one would work. And then it was a tad corny that his wife could secretly switch the music and have it target him. I mean, how does she know? She doesn't know anything more about it than he does. If anything, she knows less about it than he does. And also I didn't understand why, you know, the guest laughed at Margaret while she was dancing. I guess, you know, she wasn't being comical, and I guess we're supposed to assume it's because, you know, she's a large woman and she's moving gracefully. I don't know. I just thought that was a weird scene. You know, it was as you're saying, too long too. It just should have been shorter. And the laughing, you know, it would have made more sense if the laughing was like at a point where they see her personality changing, and then that's funny to her. But just the fact that she's dancing, that's funny. I don't know. It just was weird, you know, kind of goofy. It had a good concept, but this episode failed for me. It's too high in the cheesiness and the long scenes, and the acting was, you know, it was decent, not spectacular, but except for a couple of exceptions. Marvin, though, oh my goodness, I love that character. He was my favorite.
Cyril Delafondi.
Isn't he great?
Absolutely. He is delightful. He's a joy. He is someone you can actually say he is a joy to watch in anything he does. He's that little old man, that little
he's
old guy.
He's a little old man. That's why. It's why
and
you
that's
love
it. That little old man. Exactly.
And I'm getting more wrinkled every day, so you'll probably love him more.
And you know who else? Who else has that effect? Ernest Truex, the guy who played
another
Kiss
wrinkled
the can.
Up little old man. Yeah, of course.
That's right. No, he's not wrinkled. He's
will
not
be.
Very wrinkled. No, he will. Well, he's dead.
That's why I don't. Oh, that's why I couldn't ask him. What
do you think you do, Bobby? Go get your hair grayed, and you'd be all set then. Then you know the truth.
No, come on, guy. I mean, Cyril Delafondi was like the little old guy that you just want to hug and say, "Oh, you're so good." And Ernest Truex was absolutely the cutest little old guy. He was like what you would imagine everybody's grandpa should look like. Everybody's grandfather should look like Ernest Truex. He was just like the cutest little guy, and they're adorable. You can't hate them. You can't hate any of us that they're in because they're just so cute. Oh God. Anyway, go ahead, Ed.
Okay. Okay. So yes, Cyril Delafondi. He deserved a prize for that scene. That was great. He had me laughing out, you know, laughing out loud with that, just collapsing on the couch, and I loved it. But anyway, I don't think there's ever been a Twilight Zone episode that's actually made me laugh out loud. You know, I don't think there has been. I didn't even think that one was Buster Keaton. I don't, the one with Buster Keaton, I don't think I even laughed out loud in that one.
Oh,
it made me cry out loud.
Yeah, I know. You didn't like that one.
Beside the point.
Oh, that sucks.
It probably did for Bobby, too.
He's a guy.
And I think on that one, I think I was the only one who liked that episode that time. Well, anyway.
Oh, really? You liked that one?
Oh, yeah. I liked that one. This one, though, overall, I'd give it two. No, you know what? I'm going to say 2.5 stars only because of Cyril Delamonte. Only because of that.
And also,
see, Bobby, I'm not the only one. So there.
See? Yeah. But you know, think about this. He had to be in his late 70s at the time he did that episode, Cyril. And he collapsed on that couch.
Yeah.
And he did his little stunts there. And he was absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, he was.
Oh, he's adorable.
Yeah,
adorable.
Just nearly 73, I think he was.
Okay.
73?
Yeah, he was born in 1898. No, 1889.
Bobby went to school with him, I think.
Yes, I did. I graduated college with him.
Run one room school uphill for 50 miles.
Both ways.
No feet, no shoes in the snow.
A little house
in the
snow.
Okay.
So, you know, not an awful episode, but not memorable for me. I probably wouldn't watch it again. Well, by the way, as for acting in the Twilight Zone, this is just my thoughts on it. I think it was Bobby who mentioned this. I don't remember.
Yeah, it was me.
Okay, I don't watch
the Twilight Zone. If it
sounded cantankerous and impossible, it was me.
What's that?
If it sounded cantankerous and impossible, it was me.
All right. Well, I think, you know, though I don't watch The Twilight Zone for acting, I think the acting itself, for me, has to be good to make the story enjoyable. And if you don't have good acting, it makes it much more difficult to suspend your disbelief. I agree with that,
but it shouldn't be the overriding thing.
No, and it shouldn't be. But I think, you know, if in any genre of TV, I think, it's probably most important to have good acting in sci-fi because it's so unbelievable to begin with.
Well, let me give you an example.
Sure, yeah.
One of my favorite episodes is the Invaders. And in that one, Agnes Moorehead gives a tour de force performance. She's the only one in the story.
Yeah.
And she doesn't even say anything. So it's an amazing performance. But there's also a story behind it. There's also a creepy, scary story behind it.
Right.
Because you don't know who these things are that are invading her. You don't know until the end of the story exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. So that's a case where you not only have good acting, but you've also got a very compelling story, and that's why it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And the same could be said for the episode 2 with Charles Bronson and Elizabeth
favorite.
Montgomery.
One.
Yeah, one of our favorites.
Exactly.
And you've got a couple, they say they have lines. They do have lines, but they don't have much. They don't say much in that episode. And that's
Well,
They're
not just the
that
story,
on,
but the
yeah.
actors have to portray that to the audience
right.
as well.
Exactly.
I mean, it's important. You can get the wrong actor. And, for example, Staying on 2, if you didn't have Elizabeth Montgomery and Charles Bronson, and maybe you had, you know, Jack Albertson and Cloris Leachman, still wouldn't be
that might not have worked,
as good.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Break out the jellied chicken.
In the rainwater. You have to have the canned chicken and rainwater.
Yeah, the canned chicken and the rainwater. And but you did have good acting there, and they didn't have many lines, but the lines they had, they did well. And it was mostly...
She didn't speak neither, except for
the
one
thing. Yeah,
and
it was mostly facial, right? Facial expressions. And just, you know, remember at the end where she just looks up at him, and the facial expression is like, please forgive me, I'm sorry. You know, that's a lot of what it has to do, yeah.
That's why Sentinel was great in this role, you know, as the butler. I mean, I love it.
Yeah,
I mean, trying to hold a poker face for that long is very hard, and you have to be very actor trained to do something like that.
He was in The Silence as well. He played the butler or attendant who gave the note to Tennyson, remember, in The Silence?
Yeah. That must be his calling, butler roles.
Yeah, it must be butler, So, I'm sorry, Ed, what else did you have to go?
I think that was about it. I was just well, I was wrapping it up with the acting. For me, acting is important. Although it's not, you can have a really good episode with some mediocre actors, and it can still be good. It doesn't have to necessarily be fantastic, award-winning acting to make the episode work. But it definitely helps. That's all.
Oh, I
agree.
So what are you rating for it?
2.5 stars.
Okay, that's cool. So, and Robert, you gave it 2.5?
Yep, you did the same thing.
Okay, and I gave it, and Dave, you gave it a 3?
Yeah, certainly, I was going to give it 3.5, but I've been moderated by the company to 3.
Fantastic. Go ahead and give your rating so that we can announce it on air.
Okay, so let me
see. And I am human as well, too. Am I human? Give your rating.
Yeah. Am I human? If you have a rating for it, 1 through 5, 5 being the best, give
Bear
us
Fan
a
rating. Bear Fan gives it 2.5, so thank you, Ron.
I gave it a 3.
We don't have a 3.5 rating.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, I don't know why we did that. We
how many
one,
do
one?
I got enough in there as it
no,
is.
No, I'm just saying we had
one. I think you should do a 0.5 and then you
3.5 and 3.2 and 1.6. How many do you want?
Well, I'm just saying we have 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5, 3, 4, 4.5, 5. What happened to 3.5? We missed one there.
I didn't want
a rainbow.
I made up the rating system and I didn't want it.
You know, you can be so difficult at times.
I try to.
Please tune quick. Find a tune for
you. You don't like Stephen King? Oh my God, we've got to talk. I don't know if I can stay married to him.
Well,
let's
pull out
Stephen
that Brahms lullaby for Bobby and put him to sleep.
I'm ready to move, and now I'm not sure I want to move with a man who doesn't like Stephen King. I mean, I see him watch his movies all the time, so I don't get it. You know, you watch his movies.
Not really.
Yeah, there was a nice TV series that did kind of a tribute to King called Quantum Leap. And I believe it was the last season of Quantum Leap where they did a thing on Stephen King. That was kind of cool. And then at the end, they threw all the King tropes in, like the car was named Christine and all that stuff. So, yeah.
I remember that show. I remember Quantum Leap. But I didn't watch it all that much. You what?
I said I enjoyed it. It was a good show.
I think I watched maybe 2 episodes.
I think it closed when it did because it was just running out of steam. I think around the 4th season it was starting to run out of steam, and I think it was on the verge of being canceled. So they had to end it season 5.
Yeah, I think it was about to be canceled. They had to wrap it up quick.
Yeah,
they did not end it well. It was a really strange ending.
No. I didn't like the bar and heaven, highway to heaven type situation,
yeah.
Which is what it turned out to be, highway to heaven almost. Yeah.
I never really could figure out exactly what happened.
By the way,
it was God the bartender or whatever.
Yeah,
I forgot to mention that Piano in the House gets a 7.4 rating at IMDb.
Jeez.
But everything at IMDb gets a 7.4 rating. TV commercials get a 7.4 rating. But that's nothing new.
Well, never mind. Where's Rick? Oh, we miss Rick today.
Yeah, Rick. Yeah. If anybody can email Rick, tell him to come back here. He's been absent for too long. He missed the last one, too.
Get the next dog of an episode that you're going to announce, Lynn, for the next time.
Yes, indeed.
To serve man is the next one after that.
I want to ask Robert a question.
Definitely love that.
I want to ask Robert a question. Before I bring this up, I haven't mentioned this to Lynn yet, because she'll probably take my head off when I do. But don't you think that because after we do this next lousy episode, we're going to be off for 5 weeks, because we're moving, of course. And when we get to Philadelphia in honor of us escaping the penitentiary here and moving across the country, don't you think our first Talking Twilight Zone should be a decent episode? Don't you think
it will
be. Skip? No, it won't be.
It will be. It will be just to serve man.
You sure that's the
one?
Yeah,
that'll be the next one after this dog of one Jeff Moonbank.
Oh, so it will
be
to serve man. I thought there was one in between. Okay.
Nope.
We've got on October 13th, 2 weeks from now on October. Am I right, Robert? October 13th?
That's
our next show, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we're off for
October
5 weeks until November.
Right.
Can't we just switch?
Saturday?
Do we have to go in order?
Yeah, because I'm not going to do that lousy episode as the first one in Philadelphia.
All right. Okay. So our last episode before we move on Saturday, October 13th, we will be doing The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtlebank.
Rod Serling, creator of The Twilight Zone, will tell you about next week's story after this message. And now, Mr. Serling.
A symbol of a sad but rather commonplace event. An impressive funeral, the deceased laid out in a most acceptable manner. But in this case, at the last moment, deciding that in matters concerning the trip to the great beyond, perhaps this trip wasn't necessary. You'll see it next week on The Twilight Zone when we present Montgomery Pittman's The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtlebank. Very often when you write for a living, you run across blocks, moments when you can't think of the right thing to say. Now, happily, there are no blocks to get in the way of the full pleasure of Chesterfield. Great tobaccos make it a wonderful smoke. Try them, they satisfy.
Come and listen to a story about a man named Jeff.
With James Best. Yeehaw.
My
buddy James Best.
I never could really deal with that guy.
Yeah. Get some Dukes of Hazzard.
I like James Best.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you understand that it's James Best, right? Get in there.
That's right. It's Roscoe.
Yeah. I just can't get into him. I've watched him on so many episodes, not just The Twilight Zone. He's been in a million other things. Andy Griffith. He's been on the Andy Griffith show. I don't know what it is.
Trivia about that. I was listening. There's a show called on Talk Show, and it's a where they go and they interview past celebrities from TV shows and stuff.
James Best is still alive.
Yeah, they interviewed James Best, and they asked him about that, where he was on the Andy Griffith show and they played the guitar, and he said he can't play a lick of music, because he said they asked him, can you play guitar? He said, well, I got a couple of guitars here. So what they did was they signed him up to be on Andy Griffith. They played, and then when it came time for him to play, he told him he couldn't play. He says, well, you said you could. He said, you didn't ask me that. You asked me if I had a guitar. I said, I did. So they had to have somebody do the music for him when him and Andy would do the guitar session there
on
the porch or whatever.
See,
yeah.
I just don't like him. It's nothing. I don't know what it is. I just don't think he's that great of an actor. And
I know this is the name
same
of
character
the
and everything
show.
He plays.
He what?
He's the same character in everything he plays, if you ask me.
He does.
You know?
He plays
you know?
Like a, you know, a dumb hillbilly.
Yeah.
Basically. And all of the Twilight, he's been in 3 Twilight Zone episodes, I think. Okay.
He was in that
Western Myrtle
episode.
Bank.
Yeah.
Yes, he was in
the grave. Yeah.
Right? In Myrtle Bank and Jezebel.
Bell in 4, season 4.
Yeah, and I think he was in another one, too. And in every single one, he plays the dumb hillbilly, you know. I mean, come on, you know. Like, talk about being typecast. I mean, and even in Andy Griffith, the dumb hillbilly, you know. And it's a shame that he typecast himself so much. He could have, like, tried to say, hey, I'm going to do something else. But I don't know. I just can't get into the guy. But anyway, he's in this episode. And that'll be 2 weeks from now on the 13th.
So
and
Bobby,
then
you got something to look forward to when we come back. That will be the Serve Man. And
thank God.
The
Serve Man will be
get
our
to say
first
what you want.
Yep. Yeah, and is that going to be November 17th, Bobby?
That's November 17th, yes.
Yeah, so we are going to be out for a while.
Ooh, before Thanksgiving. Now we have a good episode to talk about before we eat that
well,
turkey.
Well, something to be thankful for.
There you go.
We'll be back in Pennsylvania. We'll be so thankful. I'll be out of this hellhole of Seattle, and I will be back in Pennsylvania. Oh, my God. We're going to have Philly cheesesteak. A Philly cheesesteak?
Yes, and we'll celebrate by watching a Stephen King movie that night.
Watch a Stephen King movie, have a Philly cheesesteak, a Philly soft pretzel, and some Italian water ice. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, you better dry ice one to me, because I would love to have a Philly cheesesteak.
I wouldn't you? Well, then you're only going to be in Ohio, and Ohio isn't that far from Pennsylvania.
Yep,
you should come
door.
Visit us.
Yeah, we'll have to do that.
Ed, where do you live, Ed?
I'm in Connecticut. So
you're not that far either. We should all have a big reunion. We should all have a big, like, you know, get together.
Connecticut looks so pretty in the wintertime with all that snow. You had all those movies made of Connecticut. You ought to be so proud to be living there, Ed.
I'm sure it's much more spectacular to somebody who doesn't live here, but yeah.
Well, I was in Connecticut about 9 years ago. I was in Connecticut in the late spring. I guess it was like early May. It was beautiful. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, it can be. I was just in Pennsylvania 3 weeks ago. So.
Where? Where?
I went to Gettysburg just to see the battlefield.
Oh, you were almost right near me. Oh.
First time I'd been out there.
Isn't it pretty?
Yeah.
Was it rainy?
No, it was a beautiful, beautiful day out there when I was there.
Did you have a Philly cheesesteak?
No, I did not.
What the hell is wrong with you?
I get pretty good Philly cheesesteaks around here, so, you know.
Around Ohio?
No,
yeah,
he went out there and had some hardtack there, Lynn. That's, you know, you got to be a part of that.
That's right.
Experience.
Hard tack. You get some hard tack like John Wayne.
Sure. I would like to say that Ohio has a good Philly cheesesteak. Come on, Ohio.
No,
Connecticut.
I'm in Connecticut. I said
Ohio, Connecticut. Have good Philly cheesesteak. You guys got to get them in Philadelphia. Don't even try it. Come on. But anyway, you going to be here 2 weeks from now? Mr. Ed?
I'll be here.
All right. Okay, and Dave?
Gotta go. My meds
yep.
are kicking in.
Okay. All right, Dave will be here, right?
Hopefully,
you'll be here,
yes, certainly will.
All right, and anybody talks to Rick, tell him to stop by. We miss him. Okay, guys, that's it. See you in 2 weeks. Have a wonderful rest of the weekend. Love to all. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye. See you in St. Louis. Screwy. Bye, all.
Goodbye, Seattle.